Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump's assertions that he routinely reaches out to Gold Star families has attracted negative attention this week and additional scrutiny. Some relatives dispute the president's assertions. Others have complained about how he made his condolences. He told reporters on Monday that he's done a better job of it than his predecessors.
If you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls. I like to call when it's appropriate, when I think I'm able to do it.
We're talking Washington politics today with veteran political journalist, political junkie, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
Ken joins us every third Thursday of the month, so get that on your calendars. Ken Rudin, the president brought this on himself, right? This was not he brought it up in a kind of a press availability on Monday.
Whenever you think of some of the things that really hurt the administration the most, much of it is self-inflicted. And this is a perfect example of Donald Trump not being forced by his opposition, his opponents, his enemies, to do this. He does it on his own. And he's so often, every time he's criticized, he'll always point to his predecessor, Barack Obama, or even Hillary Clinton, to say, well, this is, you know, Hillary Clinton did this, and why wasn't she arrested? Barack Obama did this, why wasn't he investigated? So this goes on and on. And when he said that my predecessors, including Barack Obama, did not make these condolence calls, there's no reason in the world he has to do that, because, of course, anybody with any kind of investigative bit of spine, they'll just make the phone calls. They'll just find out whether it's true or not. And so often when he makes these charges about Obama or Hillary Clinton, they're not true. So, again, this is something he didn't need to do. This is something that is instinctively what he does by lashing out at others for doing exactly what he does. And it came back to bite him.
Well, you know, why he just makes stuff up out of whole cloth, though. I mean, whole cloth out of thin air, I should say. It's just there's no basis for it whatsoever. The Obama spokespeople or representatives of the Obama administration and the Bush administration immediately retaliated on this. You didn't even have to investigate it. They came forward and said that's not true.
And I don't know why he, I mean, look, I'm beyond the fact of saying I don't know why he does this, because I've been saying that for 8 months, 9 months already. But I think the fact is that of all the things that he didn't have to do, he didn't have to make something out of whole cloth, as you say, and then you know, come back to bite him. So, you know, first, I mean, and we're also talking about this phone call to the widow of somebody who was slain in Niger. And he said, well, you know, and she says that, you know, this is what you signed up for. This is what he said to the widow of the soldier who was killed in Niger. And she says, the president said, this is what you signed up for. And she kept according to the phone call, he kept calling her your man, without even knowing what his name was. And so this is the kind of things that, you know, it's one thing to get away with things and just, you know, do what you do because you're used to doing it. But there are consequences. And of course, when it comes to the death of a soldier, which is just so horrific for the whole country, let alone the family, the president could have taken 5 minutes out to find out who this person was and have some personal reaction to it, as opposed to saying your man and him without knowing what his name was.
What about this offer of $25,000 that he said from his own money that he would give one of the families?
Well, that's another thing that basically somebody who was killed by another country's militia or army or something. He was the president promised the family $25,000. It never came. It was promised over the summer. And now it's come only because newspapers have pointed that out. So this reminds me of during the contributions that he said he gave to veterans groups months ago, when he said that he gave so many, you know, contributions and donations to veterans groups. And when the veterans group said, well, we never got a penny, then he was forced to react and then do something. So he makes a claim, he gets caught on it, and then he has to backtrack. Again, something he didn't have to do if he followed up and did the right thing to begin with, he wouldn't have had all this controversy.
Okay, so it's really kind of sidetracked what we expected to be a week revolving around the Affordable Care Act and tax reform. But before we get to that, there is a little bit of news, Ohio news, of interest at the national level. Congressman Pat Tiberi announced just a few minutes ago that he will not be seeking reelection. He has not decided a final resignation date. He said he'll be leaving Congress by January 31st, 2018. He is going to join the Ohio Business Roundtable to work on public policy issues there. He says leaving Congress is not a decision I take lightly, but after a lot of consideration, it is the best one for me, my wife Denise, and our four wonderful daughters. Okay, Ken, this is part of now a litany of names leaving Congress among the Republicans who are in control.
See, that's one thing exactly. If this was a Democrat who said, well, look, you know, the Republicans are going to be in control for the foreseeable future. Why do I have to sit in this in Congress like this and I would leave? But this is a Republican, a widely respected Republican who has a key role on the Ways and Means Committee. He's widely respected. He remember when he was first elected to Congress in 2000, he succeeded John Kasich, who endorsed him. He was a close ally of John Boehner. Of course, Kasich is term limited as governor. Boehner is long gone from Congress. And Tiberi is one of those Republicans who is one of those moderates, establishment.
Well, kind of moderate, but I never thought of
that's
him as
true. That's,
he well, seems moderate.
You know, that's funny you say that. And I was just thinking of, like, Dianne Feinstein, for example. The left wing in California sees her as a conservative.
Right.
She's hardly a conservative,
right.
But for California, I guess she's pretty moderate.
Well, she's
so
older.
She is older, but I'm thinking, like, for Tiberi to be painted as a moderate,
yeah.
When, of course, he has a solid Republican conservative voting record, but the fact is that so many in the Republican conference in the House have moved so far to the right that Tiberi is now seen as a moderate or a squishy moderate or a part of the establishment. And yes, the Republicans control the House and they may lose it in 2018. We don't know yet, of course. But the fact is that a lot of moderates like Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, and Charlie Dent, the Republican congressman from Pennsylvania, they're just frustrated by the movement to the far right by many Republicans. And they feel maybe this is not what I want to do for the rest of my life.
You know, the Congress is losing a lot of institutional memory. This cannot be, I mean, you can't, it happened in Ohio with term limits. There's just not a lot of institutional memory left in the Ohio General Assembly. And now this is happening sort of kind of artificially in Congress. It's not being forced, but he's only 54 years old.
Yeah, you know something, this is not an unusual thing. I remember a few years ago when it seemed like the Republicans were going to have the House forever, and many Democrats who have been there forever, Henry Waxman, George Miller of California, those kind of Democrats said, look, you know, John Dingell, for example, I mean, these guys were getting up in age, but they were still very effective and very respected. But they just felt that, you know, things are changing and there's no reason for us to stay in the minority much longer. So every 2 years, there is a loss of institutional memory. The especially sad part about people like Tiberi and Bob Corker is that, okay, well, they may not be moderates, but they are sensible conservatives as opposed to some people on the far right that just will back President Trump, you know, with no questions asked. Corker is very thoughtful. He's a chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Tiberi was a respected member of the House Ways and Means Committee. They know their stuff. They've been around a long time, and they know how Washington works. There were some people who said, look, I don't care how Washington works. All I know is that it's not been working well, and it's time to blow up the joint. Mm-hmm. Tiberi was never one of those kind of Republicans.
Now, of course, he is a Republican who comes, as most do, from a very safe district in Ohio. All the districts are safe, whether you're Republican or Democrat now because of gerrymandering. But, you know, this could set up quite a contentious primary race for this seat.
That's very true. And of course, you know, I mean, first of all, this came out of the blue. He was not planning to leave anytime soon, although there was some talk about him challenging Sherrod Brown for the Senate next year. And so that was always a possibility. But the fact is that there are some Republicans who, as you say, could either be term limited because of the state legislature or have been either way chopping at the bit for a possible opening. And, you know, they're going to, we often see in Republican primaries, they like to eat their own. And we'll see what happens in 2018. Look, you know, Steve Bannon has already promised a lot of warfare among establishment Republicans in 2018. Senators like Jeff Flake in Arizona and Dean Heller of Nevada and Roger Wicker of Mississippi. The Steve Bannons of the world say they're just not Republican enough, and they're promising challenges to them in the primary. So, there's going to be a true, as we've seen both parties do this over the years, but especially with the Republican Party in the advent of President Trump, there is a fight for the soul of the Republican Party, and you're going to see a lot of bloody battles in 2018.
There's a fight for the soul of the Republican Party. Is anybody winning?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we won't know until the primary start in 2018. We did see a few weeks ago in Alabama where President Trump and Mitch McConnell went down to Alabama to try to rally the Republican voters for around Luther Strange, who was appointed to the Senate seat that was given up by Jeff Sessions. But Roy Moore, the bomb-throwing former state Supreme Court justice, won that primary very easily with Steve Bannon and Breitbart's help. And they say this is what we're going to do for the rest, you know, for the Republicans for in 2018 as well. Take on the establishment, take on the status quo. And so we'll see who's winning. But, you know, right now, the fact that T-Berry is leaving, the fact that Bob Corker is leaving, that might be an indication of who's winning at the moment.
Is Alabama a good litmus test, though?
No, I mean, I don't think so. And no, because first of all, if you want to get into Alabama, Luther Strange, the guy who was appointed to the seat, he was appointed by a governor. He was a 74-year-old governor who was in the middle of a sex scandal at the time. The thought of being 74 in a sex scandal is kind of bizarre enough. But the point is that he was widely discredited. He resigned as governor because of the scandal. And basically, Luther Strange was saying, okay, I come from a tarred governor and backed by Mitch McConnell, who's not beloved among Republicans. So that may be a singular case of where the establishment lost. But Steve, it certainly gave the Steve Bannons of the world some hope for 2018, and we know that other Republicans, such as Jeff Flake in Arizona, are running scared.
My guest is veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. He joins us each third Thursday of the month. If you have a question or comment for Ken, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. We'll continue our conversation about politics in the United States. Never a dull moment. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump has halted subsidy payments to insurance providers. He has declared Obamacare dead.
They're right now having emergency meetings to get a short-term fix of health care, where premiums don't have to double and triple every year like they've been doing under Obamacare. Because Obamacare is finished. It's dead. It's gone. It's no longer, you shouldn't even mention, it's gone. There is no such thing as Obamacare anymore.
Okay. Obamacare is not dead yet, but the move could force insurance providers to raise premiums or end coverage in certain regions altogether. A proposed bipartisan compromise is on the table, but the president can't make up his mind about whether to endorse it. We're talking politics in and around Washington with veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Ken joins All Sides the third Thursday of every month, so get that on your calendar. Ken, why does the president keep changing his mind?
Well, can I just ask you one question? Now that I'm on your show the third Thursday of every month, are they talking about closing schools in Columbus so kids can stay home and listen? That should be a holiday.
I think at least they should be listening to it in classrooms across the state.
that's true. This is very interesting. First of all, okay, so you know that the president a few days ago, weeks ago, decided to cut off all the subsidies that go to the health insurance companies that allow low-income people who are getting health care to afford health coverage. So that's the president has done whatever he can to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, as he said he would. I mean, he was elected on that pledge, and he's kept to his pledge. Then on Tuesday, you have this compromise, suggested compromise by Senators Lamar Alexander, the Republican from Tennessee, who's the chairman of the Health Committee, and ranking Democrat Patty Murray of Washington. They came up with a plan that would basically fund keep these subsidies going to the insurance companies, because whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you don't want your constituents to be without coverage. So then, and that day, the president was asked about it. He said, well, it's a good idea. It's a temporary fix. Of course, it may only last 2 years, but good for Lamar Alexander, good for the fact that they're working on this, and this sounds great. Then yesterday, he said, well, you know, something is a bailout of the health insurance companies. I'm completely against it. And so several Republicans who followed Trump's lead on Tuesday by saying good things about it, like John Thune, the number three Republican in the Senate, on Tuesday said, well, I like this. And now they're saying, well, I don't like this. And then Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, said, no, we're against this. We might be able to work out something, but the president does not support this. So in less than 24 hours, and as a matter of fact, on my podcast today, I had Julie Rovner of Kaiser News, a former NPR health reporter, who's now at Kaiser Health News, who said that within the same press conference, President Trump gave different indications whether he would support it or not. So it's very unclear what's going to happen. But the point is, something has got to happen, given that there are deadlines coming up. And you know, it's very interesting, because why would the president, who wants to see the death of Obamacare, and even though the Senate has failed to kill it in all their opportunities, why would the president profess his disdain for Obamacare and then say, well, I like this Alexander Murray compromise? So there's a lot of what the president is saying is kind of confusing. What a shock. But I think that's not keeping the Senate from trying to work on compromises. The problem is, you know, you're going to get 48 Democrats supporting it. You need to get at least 12 Republicans, because you need 60 votes to pass it. Right now, you don't have 12 Republicans. You may have 4 or 5 Republicans, and that's what that's what people like Alexander are going to work for in the next couple of weeks.
What do you think the chances are, and what if it doesn't come down? I mean, then does everything fall apart?
Well, that's a good question. There's still going to be some subsidies going to the insurance companies. Some states still have working deals with these companies to make sure that the less fortunate are covered. But see, that's the thing. I mean, if you're a Republican, and yes, you've been campaigning all along saying that, you know, we have to stop Obamacare, and then you find out that a good portion of your own constituents, the people who you're representing or allegedly representing, are suddenly without health care coverage, that's a big dilemma for the Republican Party, and it's something they're going to have to weigh. So you ask, what's going to happen? I mean, if you had asked me in January, when the new Congress came in and President Trump came in, would Congress repeal and replace Obamacare? I say absolutely, because they've been talking about it for only 7 years, and they must have had a plan by now. But as we saw with John McCain's famous thumbs down and the skinny repeal in July, as we saw with Graham Cassidy last month, they still don't have their act together that will attract 50 votes. And so I guess the answer is, who knows what's going to happen.
You know, speaking of John McCain, he's pretty much thumbing his nose on a routine basis now to the president. He's still ill. He still has brain cancer. Tell me what you know about what's going on with him.
Well, the prognosis, I mean, everything I've read, the prognosis is not good, although he's still a fighter. And you know something, I'll go on social media, and it'll just break my heart to see the people who don't like John McCain calling him a traitor and a sellout. And, you know, when Donald Trump started this whole thing was that, you know, he was captured. I don't like people who were captured. And then when he needed his vote, he said, John McCain's a great hero, and I need his vote. And then when McCain had the thumbs down, he's back to criticizing people like McCain and Jeff Flake and Bob Corker and all those Republicans. So I think, you know, we always talked about John McCain as being a true maverick, and he's proven that, at least in the last couple of weeks. Look, he has great respect. He's not a liberal. I mean, just like Pat Tiberi is not a liberal.
Right.
John McCain is not a liberal. He's very conservative, but he also believes in the rule of order. And I guess, look, you know, there, a lot of politics is personal. If you're going to have the president of the United States impugn your war record when you were, you know, in a Hanoi prison camp for 5 years, that has to, you know, you just don't shrug those things off. So again, Donald Trump has made enemies over people who could logically be his allies, but the president hasn't learned that lesson yet.
Representative Tom Marino, the Republican from Pennsylvania, has withdrawn his name from consideration as America's drug czar. President Trump tweeted that on Tuesday morning. Marino's stepping back a few days after those reports of that legislation he sponsored hampered Drug Enforcement Administration and its fight against U.S. opioid crisis. What a pick. What a bad pick, I guess. Bad timing.
You know something? This fascinates me because, yes, Tom Marino was the guy who had this plan, who basically, and a lot of people said that he did the bidding of the drug companies to undermine the battle against opioid crisis, which is horrific in every parts of the country. But the bill that Marino sponsored and passed, I think it passed unanimously.
Exactly.
President Obama signed it. So to everybody to say, well, that Tom Marino, what a jerk. I mean, I can't believe he's doing that. Where was the rest of Congress? Where was President Obama when this was signed?
Yeah, but you know how much crap gets through that nobody even knows what's in those bills half the time.
Well, that's a commentary right now immediately about Congress. But that's, you're absolutely right. So, but the thing is, I don't see Marino as the ogre everybody else sees, but I'm glad that people pointed out that this bill was really doing the bidding of the drug companies, and I don't blame Marino. I don't even blame President Trump for this nomination, but it's about time that people realize what they're passing. I think it would be a good idea maybe read a bill now and then before they vote yes or not.
They're holding people's feet to the fire. Senator Rob Portman's getting a lot of scrutiny. He's been out there, standing up for funding for Medicaid for the opioid crisis in Ohio, which is probably one of the worst in the country, is one of the worst in the country in terms of opioid overdoses. I feel like I see sort of this is a catalyst or something greater, perhaps.
Well, hopefully, and I think President Trump next week is going to declare the opioid crisis as a national crisis. I don't know what that means other than just having a press conference and some kind of a national awareness of it. But it is, as you point out, Ann, it is just horrific. I know one of the reasons a lot of people thought that Rob Portman was going to be a holdout on Graham Cassidy and the skinny repeal bill of Obamacare was because Ohio was not getting enough money to fight this crisis. I mean, it was like woefully unfunded for this kind of stuff. But again, I also thought that Rob Portman would be more of an independent vote in the Senate. And right now, he has not come close to anything like Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski or John McCain as far as standing up for independence. But no, I think there's nobody more aware and no greater fighter regarding the opioid crisis than Rob Portman.
A question getting back to Senator McCain, a message from Dell on Facebook asks, does Ken Rudin see anyone poised to replace Senator John McCain?
Well, I mean, of course, our job here is not to write his obituary just yet, but we have to face reality. Mm-hmm. And I mean, people are comparing what he has to what Senator Ted Kennedy had, which wasn't good and wasn't a positive. And you know something? I mean, you know, first of all, whoever replaces John McCain will not be as independent and certainly will be more conservative. The people are looking at the governor there, Doug Ducey, who might appoint himself. Of course, that never goes well. Mm-hmm. When a governor appoints himself, him or herself, to the Senate, and then they have to face the voters in a year or two, and they say, wait a second, you know, this is not the way things work. But they're already, I mean, Kelly Ward, who ran against John McCain, got a third of the vote in the primary last year, and who was running against Jeff Flake. I mean, she basically said that, why doesn't John McCain take us out of our misery and just resign his seat? I mean, there are so many people who are just, you know, ready to bury him before John McCain is ready to go. Mm-hmm. But when he does go, and that's another thing, we always talk about that health care, the Obama repeal of Obamacare is dead and buried, not to draw that comparison, I apologize for that. But they're saying it's, and everybody says, well, no, it's not going to be dead and buried. But when, for example, if John McCain was not in the Senate with that thumbs down vote, mm-hmm. it would have passed. And if John McCain is not going to be in the Senate next year, it may pass. And if the Republicans gain seats in the Senate in the 2018 elections, which is very, very possible, I mean, the Republicans could lose the House, but they could even gain in the Senate mm-hmm. because so many of the seats up in the Senate are Democratic seats in Trump states. They'll try again to get rid of the Affordable Care Act once and for all. And who knows, maybe this time they'd succeed.
An email from Debbie. She says, I agree they should close Columbus schools for Ken Rudin's appearance on the show. She says, I want to ask Ken, does he think that the lack of teaching civics in school makes it more likely that we will see more celebrities holding office instead of qualified leaders? How can an uneducated electorate be capable of choosing qualified office holders?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, Donald Trump is not the first celebrity to be elected to higher office. We can talk to, I mean, there's Helen Gahagan Douglas in California. There's Ronald Reagan, you know, and there's Fred Grandy from The Love Boat. So, I mean, there are a lot of stars who have run for office, and Sonny Bono, for example, mm-hmm. elected to Congress. But what gets me nervous even more is that things that ordinarily would have disqualified candidates in the past, lying, sexual harassment, the thought that we would get rid of, that the candidacy of Rick Perry would fall apart because he couldn't think of the third cabinet department that he would eliminate, and yet we listen to Donald Trump on the Access Hollywood tape, and yet we elect him anyway. It's just mind-boggling. So I think the criteria and the qualifications to succeed in public office certainly have changed with Donald Trump's election, and I suspect and fear it's just going to get worse.
You know, perhaps there's nobody more frustrated by all of that than Ohio Governor Kasich. He joined on Tuesday. Well, he joined Joe Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden, in a conversation, 90 minutes of conversation, at an event co-sponsored by the Biden Institute at the University of Delaware in Newark. That's something.
It is something. I don't know what it means. I know that, you know, with his new book and his speeches around the country, obviously mm-hmm. John Kasich wants to be considered for 2020 in some calculation. I don't know if he's resonating with the Republican rank and file around the country. You know, for all his talk about how he did in 2016, he didn't do that well. I mean, right. He may have been the last man standing against Donald Trump, but he still had no shot at the nomination. So I kind of think that he thinks the hunger for a Kasich candidacy is probably greater than the reality says, but he is one of those people, one of those never Trump people who some Republicans are looking for. But again, what I've suspected for a long time now is that, I mean, who knows? But mm-hmm. I could see where Donald Trump says, you know, I don't like what Mitch McConnell's doing. I don't like what Chuck Schumer's doing. I'm going to run for re-election as an independent. And so the Republicans will put up their candidate, the Democrats put up their candidate, and Trump wins the second term by running against the status quo. So who knows? I mean, who knows? But Kasich is one of those people who thinks that, you know, the country is longing for him in 2020. I'm not convinced that's the case.
What about Joe Biden? I've heard lots of people longing for Joe Biden.
Well, you know something, sure, Joe Biden is the crazy uncle who says inappropriate things at times. But look, I'm the crazy uncle who says inappropriate things at times. But the thing is about he is a beloved figure. Nobody, whatever you want to think about Hillary Clinton, and I know people love her and people don't love her, but she was not, shall we say, a beloved figure. Mm-hmm. The only person who had worse approval ratings than Hillary Clinton in 2016 was Donald Trump. So, I mean, it was just, you know, but Joe Biden, I think he's 74 years old, and he says, look, you know, I'm finished running this, but I don't know. The Democratic Party obviously has an identity crisis. A part of it is ageism. When you think of the people who are, I mean, Nancy Pelosi is not a spring chicken. Neither is Bernie Sanders. Neither is Steny Hoyer, the number two Democrat in the House. So there's a bunch of young, vibrant Democrats who are trying to come up, who are coming up, who may be the future. The Kamala Harrises, the Cory Bookers, the Castro brothers, and not the Cuban Castro brothers, but the Texas Castro brothers. And maybe there's a generational thing as well. But as far as Joe Biden, you know, something he ran, you know, they always say that he wanted to be president in the worst way, and he ran in the worst way. He ran two disastrous campaigns in 1987 and again in 2008. But, you know, how could you not love him? He has a great story. He has a good heart. And I don't know what the American people are looking for, but he's somebody you just... Just let's watch him for 2016. I mean, maybe if Hillary Clinton wasn't the odds-on favorite, 2020, of course. Mm-hmm. If Hillary Clinton were not the odds-on favorite last year, maybe he would have given it a go. But he says, of course, the death of his son is really what decided his future.
And that felt authentic when he talked about that.
No question.
I mean, that was tough.
They were so close. He and his son Bo were just so close, and Bo Biden also had a future light up for him. He was a favorite to be elected governor, in 2016, and just to watch a life being taken at such a young age is just so heartbreaking. And you saw it in Joe Biden's face. I mean, Joe Biden is not somebody who hides his emotions, unlike, for example, Hillary Clinton, who was always thought of as calculating and distant and things like that. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden, boy, you look at him and you want to tear up with him as well.
My guest is veteran political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin himself. If you have a question or comment for Ken, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In a hearing with Senate Judiciary Committee Wednesday, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions insisted he had no improper discussions with the Russians. Democratic Senator Al Franken of Minnesota accused Sessions of shifting answers from an earlier hearing in January.
How your responses morphed from I did not have communications with the Russians to I did not discuss the political campaign, and then finally going to I did not discuss interference in the election. That to me is moving the goalpost every time.
Well, let me just say this without hesitation, that I conducted no improper discussions with Russians at any time regarding a campaign or any other item facing this country.
That's the latest from that. My guest, Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Ken Rudin, Jeff Sessions really didn't say a whole lot. It seems like Al Franken said more than Jeff Sessions did in that hearing. But it does kind of they're still focusing on Russia.
Well, they're certainly focusing on Russia, and we know that Robert Mueller is focusing on Russia as well. But But it's fascinating to watch Jeff Sessions. You know, this guy, the Attorney General, was humiliated by President Trump not that long ago when he recused himself from the Russian investigation. Mm-hmm. President Trump basically blames that recusal for the appointment of Robert Mueller as a special counsel to investigate it because Sessions took himself out of the investigation. So we saw, you know, a whole bunch of tweets from the president not too long ago calling Sessions a disappointment and weak and basically begging or at least egging on Sessions to just resign.
Right.
But not only would he, and he would not, he's come back with a vengeance. And basically, he has towed the president's line on everything with immigration and LGBTQ. I should make fun of that, but I mean, just gay rights mm-hmm. and all these things. And so when you ask him all these questions about what about the firing of Comey and what about the pardon of Joe Arpaio and what about what is the discussion about Robert Mueller and what about the Cuban government and what are they doing? He just said, well, I can't talk because it's client, attorney-client, executive privilege, which President Trump hasn't even declared, called it executive privilege, but. Calling Jeff Sessions before Congress, especially from the Democrats, is just a useless exercise. He's not going to answer anything. And unless they're going to cite him for contempt, he's just not going to talk. So it's maybe a Democratic talking point, but it doesn't get us anywhere. I'm more interested in what Robert Mueller is doing. And of course, he's not leaking. He's not holding press conferences. And you know, as we saw President Trump talk about it in the Tuesday press conference mm-hmm. at the Rose Garden, that that the president is very concerned and sometimes obsessed with what Mueller is trying to do. And again, the president will say there's nothing going on. It's a ruse by the Democrats to make excuses for why they lost. But it's obviously on the president's mind.
Some people think that he does things, throws these firebombs out there about, say, the Gold Star families to distract people from the Mueller investigation, that this is just an ongoing, that he knows what he's doing when he's doing that. What do you think?
You know something? I don't think it's that. I mean, yeah. People said that also with the attack at the NFL players for taking a knee. And they said, well, it's just distracting from the Mueller investigation or something like that. I think this is what Donald Trump does. He just gets an impulse and he tweets. I mean, the fact that he will tweet about he tweeted on the day. The day of during the California wildfires when 40, now 41 people have lost their lives, he'll talk about crooked Hillary Clinton. And I hope she runs again because I'll beat her again. And not a word about the California wildfires or mm-hmm. for the longest time, not a word about what the horrific situation in Puerto Rico. I don't think it's a distraction. I think it's just that's how his mind works. This is what gets him energized and excited and angry. And you know, you could bring in all the new chiefs of staff as you want, as John Kelly is learning. It's not going to change Donald Trump from who he is and what he does. And I mean, with the rest of us just roll our eyes. But at the same time, those same eyes of ours, we can't take our eyes off him. And we look at Twitter to say, what did the president say today? And
right.
we just that's what we do.
So I guess when you think about it, it's surprising that Jeff Sessions still is attorney general, that despite the goading by Trump, he didn't resign. Rex Tillerson, we went through something similar last week.
Absolutely. I mean, I
can't keep up with all this stuff, but it's easy to forget because now Tillerson's not in the headlines anymore.
Well, true, although the fact that he had this extraordinary press conference a week or so ago to say, I am not resigning, and then he was asked, did you call the president a moron? And he said, that's not the way I operate. I'm not talking about those things. But the fact is that, the fact is that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is in Beijing talking to the Chinese government, trying to get some kind of diplomacy to work to ward off World War III, in the words of Bob Corker, mm-hmm. Regarding North Korea. And the President Trump's, Rex, you're wasting your time. I'll deal with Little Rocket Man in the only way he knows how to be dealt with. That's astounding. I mean, it's astounding. Not only do you undercut your own Secretary of State. But basically, why would any foreign government listen to what Tillerson has to say, knowing that the president is really his own Secretary of State, his own Secretary of Defense, his own Attorney General? I mean, why have a cabinet at all when you're going to just humiliate them and undercut them the way Trump has?
Well, so he can blame them.
Well, you know, that's interesting. I mean, that's very true. That's interesting. I was thinking of Benghazi, and it was Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State, who got the blame for Benghazi, not President Obama. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you can protect yourself. Sometimes the attention and the blame goes to the member of the cabinet. And look, every president has had his battles, his battles with the Secretary of State. We mm-hmm. saw, I mean, think of Colin Powell and mm-hmm. George W. Bush. Right. There were problems there because both Cheney and Rumsfeld were out to get Colin Powell. And then you think of Ronald Reagan and Alexander Haig, who had a very strange relationship when Haig was Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. We've seen those kind of difficult relationships before, but not a complete undercutting and humiliation that we've seen with this administration.
Mike in Blacklick, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I was calling to get your guests' sense of what the appetite is across the nation regarding congressional House redistricting reform, voter-initiated redistricting reform.
Such as we have in Ohio, yeah.
Exactly, based on increasing hyper-partisanship. And I can take the answer off the air.
All right. There is a issue that's supposed to go on well, they're still collecting signatures for it, Ken, as you may know, to address the gerrymandering issue in Ohio. It's a problem across the country.
Well, that's one of the key issues that the Supreme Court is taking up this term. It's really not a congressional question. It's state assembly districts in Wisconsin. And basically, even though the Democrats got far more votes in the races for assembly, the Republicans drew the districts in such a way that Republicans control most of the districts, even though they got fewer votes. The Supreme Court will rule on this probably by June. And if they rule in the favor of the Democrats and the so-called good government groups about redistricting, then you're going to see a big effort to change the kind of way that congressional districts are run. But right now, if you're going to ask Congress whether they're going to change something, I mean, the Republicans are not going to bite the hand that feeds them. Mm-hmm. If they control the state legislatures, which they mostly do, if they control the governorships in an overwhelming number of states, which they do, why give up that power? Just like the Democrats were not willing to give up that power when they had that kind of control in the 1970s and 1980s. I think Republicans learned from what the Democrats did back then and made it into an art form. But basically, it's really undemocratic, and that's the thing that upsets a lot of people. And I think everybody's looking to see what happens with the Supreme Court.
Mike, thanks for that call. Anybody else? There's still a few minutes left. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This week, the White House did clear a major hurdle in their campaign to overhaul the federal tax system. Key Republicans, John McCain and Thad Cochran, announced support for a budget bill that could clear a path for what some conservatives are hoping is the largest tax cut in American history. It would set federal spending for the next fiscal year and also cut the number of votes required to pass a future tax cutting measure, eliminating the need for Democratic support. This is a big deal. Is it just window dressing, Ken Rudin? Could this actually get through?
It is a big deal. Whether it gets through is another question, yeah. But it is a big deal, especially for the fact that the Republicans have gotten nothing through this year, and especially because of all the promises about repealing and replacing Obamacare. This is the big one that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and even the so-called Republican dissenters like John McCain and Jeff Flake and others, they want this. I mean, of course, it will add $1.5 trillion to the budget deficit, which is not what Republicans usually support. Usually they're probably fiscal hawks. And as a matter of fact, in the House, the measure is completely different in the House because they want something that is revenue neutral that would not add to the deficit. But the Republicans seem to be gung-ho about this. It's basically the only thing they can claim as a victory if they get this done. And they want to, you know, cut the corporate tax rate, and they want to cut the tax rate to wealthy individuals. Democrats, of course, will oppose it, but if they pass it through reconciliation, which means all they need is a majority, one would think that they have the votes to do it, but then, of course, it has to coincide and coexist with what the House passes. But this is something that Trump, and I mean, Trump talks about the biggest tax rate increase, tax cut in history, even though there's no real language. We don't know what it's going to say yet, mm-hmm. but they want this very badly just to go home at the end of the year and say, yay, we got something accomplished. This is the one they want more than anything.
There was a full-page ad today in the Columbus Dispatch paid for, gosh, I may even have it with me, by a tax-cutting group. Yeah, asking Representative Jim Jordan, don't say one thing and do another. It's from the Citizens for Responsible Tax Reform. They're asking him to stay true to your word and stand strong for responsible tax reform. Our country's future depends on it. It's expensive ads. They must be coming out in other newspapers around the country at the same time. It is unusual. I mean, it is kind of strange that this came out of the House the way it did.
Now, I don't know this group. Is this group a conservative group? Because I don't think there's anybody who questions Jim Jordan's conservative bona fides. So unless it's just... I mean, I don't know what the argument is against Jim Jordan.
The only thing I can think of is that the Senate version will increase the national debt by $1.5 trillion, as you said.
Right.
They're saying the House has delivered a budget that balances.
That's exactly the difference between the Senate version, right. The Senate Republican version, and the House one. The House one. I mean, they're still fiscal conservatives, and even Rand Paul in the Senate has been saying the same thing, that we can't increase the deficit like this. We're talking about a $6 trillion tax cut plan that benefits corporations, and there must be some way of balancing that out with some kind of payment to make it so it doesn't hurt the deficit. The House conservatives are staying true to their word, mm-hmm. and maybe that's what the argument was to Jim Jordan. Mm-hmm. Don't back off from giving your word about a revenue-neutral bill. Don't fall prey to what the Senate is doing, which would increase the deficit. So there are some fiscal conservatives left in the Republican Party, but you wouldn't know it from some of the senators who are talking about this big tax cut.
Right.
Does the ad say anything about having the third Thursday off from school? Does it mention that at all?
It does not.
I didn't see the ad. We'll have to give them
a call. Citizens for Responsible Tax Reform, whatever that is.
I'll call them later.
Who knows what it is? Do you think that they could crumble under the pressure to get something through?
You know something? I've given up predicting because everything I predicted is wrong. I mean, starting with the election.
I know exactly.
But you know something? You think that all these decades of watching politics work or not work would give me some basis to form an opinion. But my goodness, I've been wrong in everything I've been seeing.
Well, you and everybody else.
Well, that's exactly
everybody.
It. And I think... And the goal really here is not to come on and predict what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's to analyze what's happening and why it's happening and what and look, the Democrats seem to be on the same page for most things, even though there are people like, you know, Joe Donnelly of Indiana and Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Heidi Heitkamp mm-hmm. of North Dakota, Democrats in solidly red Trump states who are up for re-election next year and going to have to decide whether to go with their constituents or go with their party. So there's a lot at stake, but the Republicans basically are down to their last ace in the hole, which is this tax reform, whatever you want to call it, tax overhaul. Mm-hmm. And if they don't get this, boy, that could have, you know, you go to the voters in 2018 and they'll say, what have you done for us? And they'll say, give me some time to think about it because nothing comes to mind.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, Ken Rudin, thank you so much, as always, for joining us on this second third Thursday of the month.
Well, it's my pleasure. And kids, you know, about next Thursday, you know, next month. Okay. And Ann said it would be okay.
It's kind of awkward, but if people just mark their calendars right now, get your phones out, Mark those calendars. Third Thursday of each month, Ken Rudin, veteran political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, joins us for an hour of politics. Thank you so much, Ken, and thanks to everybody else for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.